Well, thank you, Luis, for those inspirational remarks. Before we get started, I do want to acknowledge that this is the first occasion for us to be doing live streaming and broadcasting through MCHET TV. So thank you for that. We have some questions that we prepared for you as our staff gathers additional questions from the audience.
No questions. Okay.
So here's one that, that's an interesting one. In your writings, you mentioned that at a very young age, Mrs. Tremaine was the first teacher that introduced you to the arts and theater. Can you comment on this and the impact one good teacher can make on the life choices of a young person?
Yeah, that's a little brown bag story, you know, which I tell from time to time. We were in Corcoran. Actually, I haven't been to the Valley of Heart's Delight. 1946, I was 6 years old. And we crossed back into the San Joaquin Valley to pick cotton. Big labor camp by a place called Corcoran. Do you know where that is? There's some of you from the Valley? There's a big state prison there. Charlie Manson is a permanent guest. And Robert Downey Jr., you know, was a recent guest. You know, he's out of there. But in any case, there weren't prisons in those days. They hadn't really discovered the idea of making money off of incarcerating black and Latino youth. So there was a big cotton camp between Corcoran and a little town called Stratford. Maybe 2,000 people were out there, army camp, surplus, and that's who we were picking. And the cotton season ended quickly, 1946, a bit of a depression, a recession after the war, and everybody went, and we couldn't move on because my dad's pickup had broken down, it was up on blocks, and so we were living by eating fish off of the San Joaquin Delta. And one morning I almost drowned. My mother got really scared. She said, maybe you and your brother better go to school. A yellow bus used to come into the camp, so we hopped on and went to school, Stratford School, elementary school. I had my lunch. That was it. That was all I was worried about, you know. Nothing like Mama's tacos, you know. Nice and warm and fat, you know, and a little bag. A little bag that was a little grocery bag my mother had commandeered. There were paper shortages in 46. So anyway, I saw the kids, you know, the other kids had lunch pails. You know, we hop along Cassidy, Mickey Mouse, emblazoned on the side, and they'd opened it up and bring out these productions, you know, the two big pieces of whiteboard. Oh, no, it's white bread. Okay. But, you know, with bologna and lettuce, and then they had an apple or a cupcake or an orange, and here's the kicker. I mean, the thermos had milk or had Coke. And then I looked at my little bag, man, it got really sad. You know, I was ashamed, you know, I was ashamed. And I was ashamed that I was ashamed because, you know, Mama's tacos. But, you know, tacos, flour tacos, burritos, when they get cold, when nice and warm, they're nice and plump. And when they get cold, they make rather shriveled, chateados, you know. So I was embarrassed. I didn't want to pull them out. So I ate my lunch the way a wino drinks his wine, you know, one bite at a time. And the other kids were asking, what are you eating? I said, no, nothing. And you know, so they kept looking at my bag, and I kept looking at their lunches. So one day we exchanged lunches, and the rest is Taco Bell history, you know. But I saved my bag to take it back to my mom. One day I go to the closet, it's gone. The teacher sees me running, I have to go to the bus. And she says, what are you looking for? I told her, oh, a little bag, give it back. And I said, give it back. And she said, I can't. And so she escorted me into the back room, and there was my bag all ripped up, floating in a basin of water. I thought the teacher went crazy. Said, well, you're loca, la maestra, you know. And so she took a piece of the bag, dipped it in some paste, white paste, put it on the mold. First time I noticed a clay mold, a monkey, an animal. Wow, what is this? You know, it was already November. I knew it wasn't for Halloween, so what's it for? She says it's for a play. We have auditions next week. So I forgave her about the bag, man, you know. And so the next week I auditioned, got my first role in the theater, man. They needed two first graders to play monkeys. Christmas in the jungle, right? They had the school band was involved. We had a beat-up old auditorium, but they brought in fake trees. I mean, this was amazing. And as our big opening approached, I was in heaven, man. I was saying, wow, this is my debut before the world. You know, I loved it, you know. And also, my costume was better than my own clothes. You know, a little red pants, you know, and a green vest, you know, a little tail, some shoes, you know, my mask. It was amazing, a little hat. But then the week of the production, I came home to the camp, and my mother says, we're leaving tomorrow. It was like on a Tuesday. And I said, but Mom, the show's on Friday. And she says, I know, mijo, but we're being evicted. We have to go. I cried, and she cried with me, but that was it. The next morning at dawn, my dad got the truck fixed somehow, and we took off. I'll never forget, we drove through Stratford, and I saw this little town receding into the San Joaquin Valley fog, and I felt a big hole opening up in my chest, and I could have been destroyed. But again, I've always believed that a negative can be turned into a positive. And so what happened then is I took three things with me. One, the secret of papier-mâché. Really important. The other is an unquenchable desire to do theater, you know. That desire is still there. And three, residual anger, because we had been evicted. So roughly 20 years after that, I went to Cesar Chavez and pitched him an idea for theater of, by, and for farm workers. And I spoke here in Monterey to a group of superintendents, and the superintendent of that school district was here. He went back and checked his records, and he sent me, by mail, a photostatic copy of the attendance record of first grade, 1946, Stratford School. And there at the bottom was the name, Louis Valdez. The student had been in that classroom 30 days. That was it, in and out. I was there for 1 month. At the top was my teacher's name, Ruth Tremaine. Now, I don't know where Ruth is. She was obviously Anglo, but she took an interest in me. And I've always learned best from the students that, the teachers that took an interest in, that loved me, gave me a little affection. And she was the first one. I don't know where she is. She must be about 120 years old now. You know? No, I mean, but she, yeah, she'd be a little old. You know, she was a young woman, I guess. I don't know. She'd be in her 90s, you know, or something. If she's still alive, God bless her. If she isn't, God bless her anyway, because she launched me on my career. And I tell young teachers, you never know who you're teaching. I tell this to actors. It doesn't matter who's in the audience. You got five people, two of them are 6 years old. So what? You don't know who you're teaching. You don't know who's there. And so I credit Ruth Tremaine with launching me on my show business career.
Thank you.
All right.
So most arts organizations do not last more than 20 years or so. To what do you attribute the longevity and vitality of El Teatro Campesino at its 50th anniversary?
Family. It's basic, you know. And my compañera, Lupe, joined the teatro. Actually, she was my student at Fresno State. Oh, you know. Yeah, they asked me to teach a class called, they had a thing called Project 17. And in 1967, we had dinner at Dr. Rippey's. He was the father of Doug Rippey, who was our guitarronista. You know, he had been a volunteer in the huelga. So he played the guitarron. He toured with us. So his parents invited us to dinner in Fresno. And we were gladly accepted because we were eating with papas and chile, and that was it in those days. So we had a full dinner, and then after dinner, Dr. Rippey approached me and said, have you ever thought about teaching a class? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I'm the head of the experimental college, and we need a special class for 17 students. These were the first students of the EOP program. Do you still have EOP here?
Yep.
Okay. This was the first EOP class. And they needed a class for them that dealt with their cultural background. And so they asked me to do it, and I did it, a class called La Raza. And so I began then to teach at Fresno State in January of 68. I think it was the first Chicano studies class in the state, therefore in the country. And my wife, Lupe, was one of my students. Now, she was getting ready to graduate, but she was one of the Chicano activists, you know, that we met at one of our performances. Rare breed, man. We had never met Chicana activists, college-educated Chicana activists. And so she met the teatro, and from that, after she graduated, she went and taught in West Fresno. She was teaching African-American students, but we recruited her to participate in the Shrunken Head of Pancho Villa, my play, and then she joined the company. We were not romantic at first, you know? She was a member of the company. We didn't get together until a year after she was for the company, but I got a chance to see her. She says that... let her speak for herself, but she says that she fell in love with me because of the politics, which is a good way, because our politics had a lot of heart in it. You know, we're doing it for love of our people and love of social justice. And so out of that have come, of our union, have come three sons. But then the same thing goes for Phil Esparza. Where are you, Phil? Are you here? Phil has been part of our company for 47 years. He walked into my office at the teatro when he was 19 years old, and he joined and stayed. And his daughter and his grandchildren are part of the teatro. I see Rosa Vasquez here. How many years now, Rosa?
Well, that,
Apodaca y Rosa
Podaca.
Yeah, sorry. Rosa Podaca.
1971.
Okay. So we have a number of people that have hung together as a family, as a creative family, if not a biological family, because that has given us the strength to continue through our kids, through our family, and the Cesar Chavez and his family did a similar thing. It's just a trait that is very important. You know, you've got to live your life at the same time that you're struggling for things. And so just because you're in the struggle doesn't mean you can't, you have to deny yourself the basic human experience of having a family and having kids. As a matter of fact, it strengthens everything that you do. And all our children are committed to the cause, and practically all of them are artists in their own way, or actively professional artists today. And we are proud of that. We're proud of our family. And did I fail to mention, Lupe, did I fail to mention anybody in the teatro? Who Cesar Flores and Kathy, you know, they got married in Mexico City, the Quinto Festival in Veracruz at El Tajín. Right. We had a ceremony at the end of our fifth Chicano Festival in Mexico City, and also our encounter with Latin American groups. And after we were in Mexico City, we all took buses to Veracruz, and then it was culminated with a wedding of Cesar and Kathy at the foot of the pyramid in El Tajín. And as a matter of fact, they named their first son Tajín. And so that is the strength. And there are a couple also that have been married for how many years, Cesar, Kathy? 42 years. Okay. So all of this, your strength, and then I can't continue without mentioning Licha Munoz, who's our executive secretary, and she's been with the company how many years now, Licha? How many? Since 1978. So it's 38 years, going on 40. So this, everything strengthens, one thing strengthens the other. I think maybe the secret is that we treat each other as human beings, and we apologize, you know, if we make a mistake. We don't believe in the hierarchy. I'm a founding artistic director, but that gives me the right to abuse the people I work with, you know. So I don't believe I'm a boss. I try not to be. I'm an insistent artist. I've been known to work these guys, you know, but fortunately, a handful, you know, have stuck together and given the teatro the ability to be able to continue to function in the 51st year, mm-hmm. and have given us strength. It's the strength of family and love and friendship.
And why San Juan Bautista?
Because San Juan Bautista was once the capital of California. A lot of people don't know that. And because it's a living wellspring of not just California history, but American history. And there was a village there, you know, called Papilachum, that belonged to the Mutsun, or Ohlone Indians, that lived there. And that's why the Spanish priest came and established a church there, the mission, which is, again, three naves, the largest basilica of the 21 missions in California. But more than that, it still looks like California out there, the pristine California I remember from the time when I was a kid. The landscape is unchanged. It's wonderful. Small farms. And there's a sign that one of the merchants put out, come to San Juan Bautista and refresh your soul. And I think that's a fact. When we moved there in 71, we had been through a lot of strife already. We had been actively in the movement for 6 years. We had been crisscrossed the country. We had been jailed. We had been beaten. You know, we'd been everywhere. So when we came to San Juan for a summer workshop, thanks to the invitation of Manny Santana, who had just purchased Jardines, he'd opened up Jardines, I found it irresistible. I said, man, this is great. And we were at the point where we were beginning to raise families, so it was a perfect place to raise our families and to begin to focus on our art, not just our politics. We wanted to make art, and we wanted to be artists, and San Juan gave us that opportunity. From San Juan, we continued to tour. We went all over the world with the Teatro Campesino. And we've had people come from all over the world to visit us. It's still small, you know, with thank God, you know. But I'll tell you, the increase of the population of California has impacted us, even in San Juan. We can't get to Gilroy without running into traffic jams, you know. We can't get to Hollister now without having a backup, you know. Coming to Salinas sometimes is really impossible. That speaks to the growth of the population. San Juan, miraculously, has remained the same. It was here when Monterey was here, so there were people coming and going. But there's a lot of history there. And on both sides of the political spectrum, believe it or not. And the U.S. Army had to put a company of regulars in the Mission Plaza during the Civil War because the Southern sympathizers were so strong in San Juan Bautista. We had Confederates in town. And that speaks to the lack of diversity in San Juan, you know. We used to have more Asians before World War II, a lot of Japanese Americans. I'd like to see a Japanese restaurant come back. Our Chinese restaurant burned down. I'd like to see another Chinese restaurant. You know, we have two Mexican restaurants, you know, at least. and that's all right. That's good. But we need, you know, we need the diversity of the human race. And it's starting to happen. But more than that, we're part of California. And people need to know that little places like San Juan Bautista were once the capital of the state.
And why humor pervades your works. Why so much humor?
Well, because nobody's going to get out alive, you know. And because God has a sense of humor, you know. If God did not have a sense of humor, I would not have this voice. And Mike Tyson would not speak like this. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, it I think that the humor is like a reflex, you know. It's also a release of energy. This is why we laugh. We release. Tension gets released. So in some ways, it's the way through the heart, you know. You laugh with your heart. You laugh, you know, heartily. There goes again. You laugh heartily because it shakes your whole makeup, and it's good for you to laugh. It's been shown, you know, in medical practice that laughter is good for you. And so I use that as almost for therapeutic reasons. If you can laugh at somebody that you fear, the fear becomes less than what it was, you know. And so satire is important. And I think we're going to have fun with Donald Trump. We'll continue, you know.
I was wondering.
He's a natural man, okay? All right.
Certainly, Alec Baldwin is having a ball.
And Alec Baldwin's already going, man. It's revived his whole career. It's great, you know. It's amazing.
So, this question is not here, but it's popped into my head. When I was in college in the late 60s, there were two companies that really kind of, you know, were high profile for us in college. One of them was Teatro Campesino. The other one was San Francisco Mime Troupe.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm wondering, were there any connections between the two? Did you guys talk to each other? Did you?
Yeah. I was in the San Francisco Mime Troupe.
Ah, okay.
I went from San Jose State, fledgling playwright. I'd just done The Shrunken Head of Pancho Villa. And I figured, okay, what's my next step? I'm going to go to a theater center. And San Francisco at that time was actually the place to go, more than L.A., if you're going to do theater, because of the Actors Workshop and then the San Francisco Mime Troupe. And so I saw them perform in the streets, and I was totally taken with them. I said, I want to be part of this group and learn what they do. Hmm. And Commedia, with the use of the masks and the homemade props, everything just attracted me. So I had been to Cuba in the summer of 64, which is another story altogether. But they invited me to come and talk about Cuba. And then once I was there, Durrani Davis, who was the artistic director, asked me if I wanted to participate in workshops. And so I did, and moved to San Francisco and began to work with them. Working in the parks. But more than that, the intellectual conversations. Our business manager was Bill Graham. I don't know if the name resonates beyond my generation, yeah. You know. He was a rock impresario. But the way that he got going is that we were doing a play in Lafayette, well, throughout the parks, Lafayette Park, as it turned out, in San Francisco. And it was a Commedia that had been adapted, written originally by Giordano Bruno, who was a 16th century Italian playwright who was burned at the stake by the Inquisition for heresy. So we took his Commedia called Il Candelaio, the Candlemaker, and adapted it to our times. It had to do with censorship and stuff. And so the police accused the mime troupe of performing obscenities on stage. And it was a character of Pantalon, this character with a Commedia mask, a classic Commedia character, with a little hat. It's an old, bumbling old man character. And he peed in his pants in the piece, but not literally. I mean, he didn't expose any flesh. Actually, he did this. That was it. No water, just, you know. And so the cops were waiting, and they said, "That's obscene." And so they rushed in and arrested Ronnie Davis, our director. And actually, I would have done the role. I was the first guy out on the stage. But Ronnie said, no, I'm the artistic director. I'm not going to get arrested. Let me do it. So I said, here's my mask. You're welcome to it, you know. So he went out there, and he got busted. And there's a shot of him, you know, being hauled away with Bill Graham behind him. And Paul Jacobs, an old East Bay radical. And I'm there smoking my cigar right behind them. But the fact is that Bill Graham saw this as an opportunity to fundraise for the mime troupe. Mm-hmm. And we were, at that time, operating out of a loft on the corner of 7th and Howard in downtown San Francisco. And on the second floor was where the mime troupe had its rehearsal hall, big with an industrial elevator and a stairway. Well, when I got to the party, the fundraiser, the place was packed. It was wall-to-wall people. There was a cloud of marijuana smoke, you know, above, between the crowd and the ceiling, and that was it. But the bands that played were the Jefferson Airplane, the Warlocks, soon to become the Grateful Dead, Country Joe and the Fish. It was the 60s, essentially, exploding in the mime troupe loft. And so Bill Graham was at the door collecting tickets and the money, rather. And so he was wild, man. He said, wow, we got to do this again. And so he took us all over to the Fillmore Auditorium, and he set up a much bigger fundraiser with rock bands for the mime troupe. And after that one, he made so much money that he said, forget the mime troupe. Now I'm going to go into business here. And so he used the Fillmore Auditorium as a launching pad for all these rock groups. Carlos Santana at the time was a young guitarist in his early 20s. Mm-hmm. And he tried to get into the Fillmore, couldn't afford to buy a ticket. So he crawled in. He snuck in from the top. He found a door that was in the roof. And they caught him. They caught him and took him to Bill Graham. And Bill Graham says, what do you do? I'm a musician. Okay, well, you can get in. And that's where Carlos Santana began his career, under the auspices of Bill Graham. So you can see, I mean, it was the countercultural revolution happening. Peter Coyote was in the company at the time. Yeah, and a number of others, you know, that were fabulous, brilliant people, very dedicated to, again, the same ideals. Very few Latinos. There were a couple of us. That was basically it. But really, I was flabbergasted by what was happening in San Francisco and joined that movement and did not leave until Delano beckoned, you know, in the fall of 65. I had to leave San Francisco and Haight-Ashbury to go back to my origins in Delano to fight the good fight.
Right. Thank you. So now we're going to have a 50th anniversary production of Zoot Suit in
yes.
L.A. What can you tell us about that?
Well, Phil may explain it. We started selling tickets on Thursday, and we had an outstanding response from people. People with Zoot Suits coming out. I think it impressed people at the taper, you know, but the potential, because 40 years ago, almost 40 years ago, Zoot Suit opened the doors to the professional American theater, to Latinos, basically. And it did it with the power of the box office, that people saw that this was happening. This is beyond the importance of making a statement, you know, from that stage, a statement about Los Angeles history. I thought at the time that it had the resonance that it had because there were so many survivors from the Zoot Suit riots on both sides of the struggle, and that it made a lot of sense for Los Angeles to explore its own history. But it became pretty evident that we were really exploring a chapter of American history, something that was really essential that people needed to see. And that we began to draw then people that had never been in the theater before, ever in their lives. This was a first play for a lot of people. As it turns out, in the intervening years, I found out that the play inspired a lot of people to become directors and playwrights and actors. And some of them made names for themselves. Certainly the original Zoot Suit cast, with Eddie Olmos in the role of El Pachuco, and my brother Daniel playing Hank, you know, Henry Reyna, led the pack, you know. But Lupe Ontiveros was part of the original. She went into Hollywood, you know, and played maids, you know, 1,500 times, you know. She passed away from cancer, unfortunately, but she's well remembered and revered by her colleagues. Tony Plana also became an actor. I mean, all a whole Zoot Suit cast, in a way, opened the way for the Latinos that came behind them by going into the professional theater and by going into television and film. This time, we've got a whole new wave of actors coming in. You may have heard or read that Demian Bichir is going to be playing El Pachuco. Demian was most recently nominated for an Academy Award for a picture called A Better Life. He's a Mexican actor, but classically trained. He comes from a family of actors. He's bilingual. And so I figured, great, he wants to do it. Let's do it, you know. But we have a whole new generation of young actors, again, of every stripe. I've been very deliberate now in making sure that we're well represented, the whole spectrum, you know, that Asian Americans and African Americans and Latinos, you know, of all kinds, Puerto Ricans and Dominicans, are represented, you know, in the makeup of the cast. And it's going to be a tremendous cast. And the straight all-American types, you know, for the sailors and the lawyers and the cops, all of that. It's going to be a wonderful production, if judging from the talents that I have seen and the support that we're getting from Michael Ritchie, who's now the artistic director of the Mark Taper Forum. My original collaborator, Gordon Davidson, recently passed away a few weeks ago, months ago, I guess, and he was very instrumental in bringing me there, bringing El Teatro Campesino. He helped to integrate the Music Center by inviting El Teatro Campesino onto the stage to perform La Carpa de los Rascuaches, and then inviting me as a playwright to write about the history of Los Angeles as part of the New Theater for Now series. So it is a tribute, and certainly to Gordon's memory, I'm going to dedicate the play to him, that Zoot Suit is still around and that it's still finding its audience. If you haven't gotten your tickets, please get your tickets because they're going fast. The last time around, we sold out before we opened. There are only 8 weeks. So get your tickets now if you're going to go, you know. If not, we'll see it when you see it, you know. But it's going to be a whole revisitation. I've made changes, believe it or not. The process continues to refine certain points. More attention to the Pachucas, particularly this time around. But in fact, it's the same piece of history seen again in our time. And I think that this piece of history will be instrumental in speaking to all Americans about what's happening today. It was hatred and racism and fear, war hysteria, that created not just the Zoot Suit riots and the Sleepy Lagoon case, but also the Japanese internment, you know, in these various camps. And the racism has always been there. And we need to constantly refer to this. It doesn't happen, you know, as much as to the depth that it's happening in certain parts of the country. So I hope that Zoot Suit then sees you in the audience, okay? Certainly a pleasure for me to be there. It's wonderful. Okay? Gracias.
So 2 weeks ago, Americans were stunned with the results of the presidential election. Can you talk to us about how your view of the next 4 years regarding how the arts can help our community, how our youth can deal with their concerns and fears as we move forward?
Well, don't hate. You're going to hear that from a lot of veteranos, you know, because the hatred, hate the injustice, but not the people. It'd be very easy to start flinging hatred in every direction. We're going to get enough of that. It's going to be there. And anger and hatred is like poisoning the well. All it takes is one angry person in a crowd to make the whole crowd go crazy. And we're seeing some outrageous, I can't believe it, it's like a joke, some outrageous expressions of hatred and racism that were there apparently just below the surface but had not felt compelled or even free to be able to express itself. And now it's happening. And now we have to counter. And I speak to the young especially because this is just the beginning of the rest of your life. Welcome to the 21st century. And it's going to take concerted effort. It's going to take concerted action. I go back to the hope that we engendered for ourselves during the war in Vietnam. It was very bitter, concentrating all our actions on trying to stop that war, and it finally stopped. It's tremendously frustrating, but we did finally stop it. I mean, it did happen. And so I don't know if there's a war ahead of us. If it is, it's going to be terrible. We cannot afford to entertain it. because of nuclear weapons. I mean, obviously, that's been the thing, the legacy we've had there since the 50s. So we need to believe in our country and believe in protests and demonstrations, but also work on our legislators, work on our representatives. They have to do whatever they can do in Congress in order to block some of the possibilities that are happening. And there has to be dialogue. There has to be dialogue about, if not this, then what? What do we want for ourselves? And certainly it has to do with education, because the diversity and in all our campuses is a wonderful thing, but it has its critics. Some people don't believe the university should be this diverse. The birther diatribe and slander against President Obama hinted that he got into Harvard, you know, because he was black, which is ridiculous. He got there because he's brilliant, because he's cool, you know? And it was a pleasure for me to be there and to shake his hand in the White House and to see other people, a little brief shining moment in the White House. But it's no surprising now that those windows and closed and doors are starting to close. They say, no, no, you don't belong here. This is the White House. This is the White House, you know? Not the Brown House. But someone wrote a book, I saw it recently, Brown is the New White, you know? And as a matter of fact, there are more brown people on earth than, which reminds me of an old story I used to tell, that when God made the human race, he put together the human flesh into a mold, you know, and then he put it in the celestial oven to cook. And he pulled it out too soon. It came out too pale. He said, oh, well, I'm going to put it aside. So he rolled up another one and put him in, you know, said, I'm going to leave it a little bit longer. And pull him out, and it came out black. He said, okay, that's a little extreme, okay. Third time is the charm. So he put it in there, and it came out a golden brown. You know, it was wonderful. So it's a question, a point of view, you know. Oh, actually, black people are not black, you know. They're technicolor. I've seen it for myself, you know. I was in the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco in the 60s. And there was a thing called acid, you know. And I remember on one of my initial journeys, you know, I went to a jazz musician, a friend of mine who was a jazz musician, he's African American. I couldn't believe his skin, man. It was like iridescent. And black people in general are not black. They have a lot of pigments, and that's why colors work on them so brilliantly. And you see it in folk cultures, you know. You see it in Mexico, all the colors. That's because of the dark skin. That light skin is fine, too. You know, it's all good, okay? It's all good. You don't have to put up one at the detriment of the other and at the sake of another. You put it all together. You say, it's all good. It's all beautiful. Of course it is. And it's a lot of people that listen to me speak. I say, you know what? I'm a student of Western civilization. I was taught by wonderful people and wonderful professors. I love Western civilization. I subscribe to it all. I subscribe to the ideals. I subscribe to the idea of the social contract. What's wrong with that? You know? And even here, in the history of California, I hear the echoes of those young intellectuals that were here as the Americans arrived. Mariano Vallejo, you know, Jose Alvarado, Jose Castro, who's house is still in San Juan Bautista, and the art museum here in Monterey was his old house here in Monterey. They were intellectuals, and you know, they were pondering, how long is it going to take Mexico to get here? Maybe, and we see the British coming, the Russians are coming, the Americans are coming. Who are we going to line up with? And actually, a lot of them were interested in lining up with the British. They said, we should go with the British. But anyway, they ended up, when the Americans came, they adapted. They became the first Mexican Americans. Mariano Vallejo, who was the general of in this area that was receiving, you know, he has the head of the army, if you can call it that was here in California, in Northern California. And then there was another one in Southern California, Andres Pico. These are the Lanceros, you know, the Californios. Well, the Bear Republic revolt started in his yard, in the front yard of Mariano Vallejo. And he had two sons. One was Platón, translates as Plato, and the other is Uladislao, whom they used to call Ula. These two young kids, they saw the Americans, these gringos come, and then they raised the Bear Fire Republic in the front yard of Mariano Vallejo and arrested Mariano Vallejo and took him prisoner. What happens? Okay, he decides to become an American. He says, I am an American. Platón went to school in New York. He became a doctor. He went to medical school in New York City. He was there in 1860. He was there in 1861. He was drafted by the Union Army to serve as a doctor on the battlefield in behest and in defense of the Union Army. And this was Platón. Uladislao went to Mexico to fight against the French occupation in defense of Benito Juárez. And Mariano Vallejo actually went to Washington. He went first to New York to visit his son, and then to Washington, where he was received in the White House by Abraham Lincoln. This is all California and American history. And he was there. The wife of Benito Juárez and his children were received in the White House by Abraham Lincoln because they had left Mexico to come to New York just to survive when the French were occupying Mexico. So that idea of who are we, how can we become Mexican American, has precedence. And the fact is that this part of the country has been full of that dialogue from the very beginning, and Chicanos now that come to CSUMB should know that they're in a historic area, that Monterey was the breeding ground of intellectuals in old Spanish California, as limited as it was. There weren't too many people here. And yet, there was a certain perspicacity among the young here that we need not to lose. We need to remember people like Mariano Vallejo and Jose Alvarado and Jose Castro and Juan Alvarado, intellectuals from our past. And more than that, let me just state that this spot right here, I mentioned it before, I'll mention it again. One of the reasons we called this the World Theater was because as we were scouring the campus back in 95, deciding where we were going to do things, we had a big discussion that there was going to be a big performing arts center established behind this building. It was a $50 million project that was spearheaded by Peter Smith, you know, who was one of our first presidents. And we discovered that the ground right behind this was used by the Native Americans here, the Ohlones, who lived here, for ceremonial purposes. So we said, that's where we'll put our performing arts center, right back here. And you know what they called this area? They called it Dancing at the Edge of the World, in their language. So we said, well, we're going to put a theater, we're going to call this the Dancing at the Edge of the World Theater. It's too long. We'll just call it the World Theater. But a lot of people don't know that that's where it comes from. We were relating to the history of this place, and we were trying to emphasize the humanity of all the inhabitants that have ever been here. There's no such thing as savages. There's no such thing as people that are backward. It's like there are no people that are illegal. That's not a noun. Backward is not a noun. It's a description from a certain point of view. We all have something to give to each other. And every wave of humanity that has come to California has brought their own personal, spiritual, physical, and cultural riches, as well as their genes. And those genes are now getting mixed, and that scares a lot of people. But there's nothing to be afraid of. There is nothing to be afraid of. There is no loss of humanity. There's only an increase of humanity by allowing this human interchange.
On that note, let me thank you for the wonderful remarks.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you.
We have We have Congressman Sam Farr here to present Luis Valdez with a commendation.
Hey, Sam!
Well, it's such a. I don't want you to stop talking. I think this is the best hour, 2 hours I've ever had in my modern life, and I sit through a lot of speeches in Congress. But you're just, you know, I love it, talking about how this is where California began and what all that beginning was. But I'm here today because I'm just a year younger than you are.
Whoa, okay.
And I had my whole history just told to me and all the passions that I had through all the eras of the assassination of Kennedy and the Vietnam War and so on, the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. But I had the privilege, having been your elected official, to be asked to, when they said, do you want to go down to the White House? Because President Obama is going to give the National Medal of Arts to Luis Valdez. And I said, He's my hero. He's from my district. I'm going to be there. And it was such a proud moment. I wished everybody could have just seen. There are a lot of artists there. And, you know, I kind of grew up with a Valdez when I was in the Peace Corps in Colombia. Mm. It was Juan Valdez who was selling coffee. He was an actor. Come home and get to know Luis Valdez and think this is, you know, he is really, to me, swearing in ceremonies for new citizens, for immigrants, and love to have him as a keynote speaker. He's just phenomenal. He's a voice of God. And but it's just such an honor. And I think, so what I did is I realized that I was privileged to be able to honor to be with you when you were being honored in the White House. Mm. And I just thought, Weiss, you know, when you got into the White House, you fit. I think you ought to be there, because if you were there now, then we could have the State of the Union address given by you, and I think it would be a lot more effective than the one we're going to get. But I wanted to be able to, with my peers here in your hometown, I mean in your home district here, and to be able to present you with a congressional record honoring you for receiving this award and talking about you being in the White House and about your background that you've talked about. Mm. And I just want to say it's a real privilege to do it here among your peers. So I wanted to come here and present this with you. And then I conclude, most of the things in here you've told about in your life story, but I conclude by saying, Mr. Speaker, and I'd much rather have called him Madam Speaker, but we do have a Mr. Speaker right now. And I know it says, Mr. Speaker, I know I speak for the whole House when I extend our congratulations to Luis Valdez for his most recent of honors. It comes on the top of a lifetime of achievement, giving voice to those voiceless that have been so often missed or dismissed by our broader society. In light of recent events, his voice is more important than ever. Mm.
Thank you. Absolutely. Let me reciprocate and thank Sam for all of the years of service to our community. I'm proud to say I helped him on a couple of his campaigns to attract voters to his side, but he's been a champion of our community. He never fails to come to visit all of us. We've seen him in San Juan Bautista and in Hollister. And he's just an outstanding example of what Congress is supposed to be. And so, Sam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have one more.
One more, okay.
One more commendation for you.
Like from Christmas here, okay.
From Assemblyman Luis Alejo.
Oh, another.
Thank you.
Another champion of the people here. All right, Luis.
Thank you. Dr. Choa and my tocayo, as you say in Spanish, we have the same first name. That creates an automatic relationship among Latinos. But I'm here to recognize my constituent as his assembly member, but also as the chairman of the California Latino Legislative Caucus and as a political science and Chicano studies major. I'm really proud to recognize an exemplary and one of our trailblazing Chicano activists and leaders and playwrights, not only Luis, but his other half, Lupe Valdez. You cannot tell Luis's story without telling Lupe's story as well. So,
bravo.
But many of us who grew up in farm worker families, and my grandparents were one of the first families to join the United Farm Workers in Salinas and in Watsonville in 1970. But I want to recognize also Luis today, the inspiration and the groundbreaking, the foundation that he laid for many young children and grandchildren of farm workers to believe that they could reach their full potential, that they could go to the university, get their degrees, and even one day serve in the legislature in the sixth largest economy in the world here in California.
There you go.
And what you said earlier was reminiscent of what we went through when I was 19 during Prop 187 in 1994 during Governor Pete Wilson, who was attacking immigrants here in California, and the initiative passed by 60%. Many of us then committed ourselves that we're going to go to college, we're going to get our degrees, get experience, but come back and dedicate our careers to public service. And 20 years later, we're passing some of the most pro-immigrant rights legislation here in California. I was the author of AB 60, the driver's license for immigrants, author of raising the minimum wage to the highest level. And last year, we passed the first bill in the country to create the first model curriculum on ethnic studies here in the great state That's of California. Right. All because of your inspiring work. And even last August, California became the first state to pass overtime for farm workers after 8 hours, the first state to do that in the nation.
Wow.
But Beautiful. An inspiration and a testament to Lisa's work in inspiring that next generation of leaders and actors, and that message is still the same to resonate, that hopefully out of this university, we'll have the next generation of artists, leaders, and playwrights, but also elected officials who commit doing, commit their careers to creating just laws for all Californians and all people across America. With that, I want to provide this nice resolution on behalf of myself and your state senator, Bill Monning, who's a longtime friend of yours as well, to recognize the great work you've done as one of California's finest citizens. Muchas gracias.
Thank you, Tocayo.
Gracias.
All right. Thank you.
I accept this in the name of all the Teatro Campesino, okay? It's just not an individual, it's a group. Not a single person, it's a family. It's a wave, not a particle. A wave that we're all part of. Okay.
And last but not least, Luis, we want to give you a little sweatshirt for memento.
Very good. Now it's getting cold. Yeah.
Yeah. Please join us in a reception right outside the theater with Luis.
Thank you.
And others.